This is KCRW, live from Oxnard College. I'm Jonathan Bastian. In collaboration with the Ventura County Star, I want to welcome our listeners joining us and our live audience to a conversation about the future of undocumented immigrants in Southern California under the Trump administration. Oxnard is home to thousands of undocumented immigrants and in many ways is representative of towns and cities across Southern California. Just today, President Trump signed an executive order to begin construction of a wall along the border of Mexico. He also vowed to defund sanctuary cities. Then there were his previous statements of deporting 2 to 3 million undocumented criminals and potentially eliminating DACA, Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. Now, many undocumented people in Oxnard and beyond are concerned about how all of this could tear apart their lives, their jobs, and their families. Today, we'll listen to those concerns and discuss what the future could bring. Joining us tonight are four panelists from vastly different backgrounds. Naira Pacheco is an outreach coordinator at Just Communities and has been living here undocumented since she moved to the U.S. from Mexico at age 6. Hi, Naira.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Jeff Dean is the Ventura County Sheriff. Welcome, Sheriff.
Thank you.
Gabriela Navarro-Bush is an immigration lawyer working in Ventura County. Gabriela, hi.
Hi, Jonathan. Thank you for having me.
And finally, Mike Stoker is an agricultural law attorney and former Republican Santa Barbara County Supervisor. Let's begin the discussion tonight. Naira Pacheco, I want to begin with you tonight. Can you give us a sense of what it's like being undocumented in this country, and it's been a number of years for you, and really how this experience has changed since Trump was elected?
Okay, sure. Well, I came to this country in 1996 when I was 6 years old. So that was 2 years after Prop 187 had been passed, and then a year after that, the proposition was overturned. 2 years after, or 1997, bilingual education was banned in the state of California, so I had to struggle through navigating that situation as a monolingual Spanish speaker. In high school, H.R. 4437 was introduced and passed in Congress, very anti-immigrant propositions. And then in 2009, I survived the expansion of the deportation machine under the Obama administration. So I think largely my experience in this country as an undocumented person has been that of constant fear and uncertainty for myself and for my family and for my community. So I think that when I think about what's happening right now, it's simply the outright and blunt and direct expansion of everything that I've lived through in my life.
Tell us also just a little bit about your family. You know, we talk about families that have a mixed immigration status. Is that the case with you and your family as well?
It is a case for my extended family and for my immediate family. All of us are undocumented, undocumented into this day as well. So I think, again, I came to this country being very aware of my undocumented status, being very aware and proud of my Mexican roots. And being very aware that there was anti-immigrant sentiment all around me, especially even in the state of California. So despite that, my concern has always been for my family members, just constantly worrying about whether they would be stopped for a DUI checkpoint, a supposed DUI checkpoint, if raids were to happen at work. Most of my family has actually been employed by the Santa Barbara News Press, the only news press to endorse Trump, yet ironically hires undocumented immigrants to deliver their newspaper. So I think, again, it's been constant just fear around more directly my family, because as we've seen, policy has shown to be a lot more favorable to undocumented students and youth. But that's not to say that we stop living in fear, because our families, our communities are still under threat.
Gabriela Navarro-Bush, as the immigration lawyer up here, tell me about how your work has changed since Trump got elected. Have you been busier than normal? What are some of the calls that you're fielding right now?
Well, my office has always been pretty busy, but it has spiked significantly, especially after the election. A lot of people are afraid. They don't know what direction to take. A lot of Dreamers are very afraid of whether they should apply, renew. They're afraid of their families. A lot of what I hear are stories of going to the market and then being confronted by an immigration officer and having that person hauled into an immigration center while their children are left behind. I mean, I grew up here in Oxnard. I lived next door to a strawberry field, and it wasn't unusual to see the green vans patrolling the fields and people running in different directions. As a kid, you know, we would jokingly scream out, "Ahí viene la migra," and it's not funny anymore because these are genuine fears that my people in my community have. Immigration is very personal to me, not only because this is the kind of work that I do. I had two brothers that were U.S. vets that were both deported, and one died within a year of being deported to Mexico. We deport U.S. vets, and so I have a lot of people that have that fear. I mean, if they're here undocumented, what rights do they have to remain here when we have people that served our country and despite maybe minor crimes that they committed, we are willing to deport them even though they were willing to die for us. So the fears are genuine. I'm trying to do as much as I can to expand my legal rights clinics that I try to do with a lot of community-based organizations. I've been called on by several community colleges, Oxnard College, Ventura College, Cal State Channel Islands, to provide just information because people are just hungry for information on what they should do, what to expect. And I wish I could clone myself, I guess.
Is there anything specifically right now that people are asking you about in light of the Trump presidency?
I think what they're more afraid of is having immigration officers come to their home to arrest them, having them being arrested in public. Is there any way that they can try to legalize those? That's what they're more afraid of. The fact is that we have laws that allow certain people to fight their immigration cases. So in some situations, people may be able to get their residency through the legal process of fighting a case in the immigration court. It's a little complex for a radio program. It would take too much time, but people need to know their rights. And I think that that's what a lot of my appointments are. What rights do I have? What can I do if I do get stopped by immigration?
I want to go now to you, Mike Stoker. You have supported Trump throughout the process and the campaign here, and there's a lot of fears out there. And I wonder if you think some of them are unjustified right now, if some of this fear is unjustified as we begin to slowly learn what Trump is going to do.
Well, I didn't support Trump until there was no longer any other Republicans in the election. And I was asked, I agreed to do the same thing for McCain and Romney, to serve as an agricultural advisor. And as a person that's been advocating for immigration reform for over almost 30 years now, I wanted to be in a position to at least give as much input, hopefully, to give the kind of ideas that people like myself have been advocating. I'm on an executive committee in Washington called the Agricultural Coalition for Immigration Reform, which are the leading ag players that have been promoting immigration reform. A lot of the stories you just heard from the prior two speakers, that's how frustrating it is. That didn't happen with Trump. Those are the stories of what's been going on in this country the last 20, 25 years. And it's frustrating because we've desperately needed immigration reform. And until we get it, we're going to continue to have people living in fear. My real frustration, I first testified back in 1995 to Congress as chairman of the California Ag Labor Relations Board on immigration reform. I have fought for 12 different versions of immigration reform since. Most people in the farming community, the agricultural community, and most of the farm workers I work with, frankly, whether it would have a pathway to citizenship, or a three-year work permit and legal status, they really don't care. What they want is being able to be in some kind of framework that the federal government offers that offers them to be here legally. Okay. And what I've been working for and what I think we have a really good chance of potentially getting And I'm keeping my fingers crossed, and a lot of the people I've talked to in high-ranking levels with the Trump administration. It's my belief that, you know, yes, the wall was something he campaigned on, and he wants border security. And he wants to do what needs to be done to stop people from coming in the country illegally. I really strongly believe that you have a very, very good chance that through the Republicans in Congress, which Trump would agree to with the administration working with those Republicans, I don't think you're going to see the kind of things that people are talking about that potentially could happen. I don't think you're going to see a lot of raids and roundups. You're going to see a focus on people that are here illegally that have committed serious crimes.
Okay.
And I think what the game plan is going to be in the next 3 to 5 to 6 months is roll out some kind of green card program that everybody here illegally could apply for, get a 3-year work permit, and then continue to roll them over every 3 years as that time period comes up.
Well, we'll get to that a little bit later. I want to now talk about one of Trump's big promises, which was the deportation of criminals. He says there's some 2 to 3 million, and we have a short clip of Trump talking about this. Let's take a listen.
When Mexico sends its people, they're not sending their best. They're sending people that have lots of problems, and they're bringing those problems with us. They're bringing drugs, they're bringing crime, they're rapists, and some, I assume, are good people.
Okay. I want to now go to Sheriff Dean, because you play such a vital role in this conversation in terms of interacting with a community here that has a lot of undocumented workers, the extent to which you are going to work with ICE and all of that. But first, I want you to kind of react to this last statement. You are, again, working with a number of these Mexicans crossing the border. Is it the case that there is a correlation between an undocumented person and very high levels of crime?
Well, I'm not going to debate those facts. I don't know what is in fact and what's not. I can tell you the reality, as you and I have talked about, is last year we booked over 27,000 people in our jail, and we notify ICE of those that might be in the country illegally, and they remove 238, so less than 1%. And I don't want to read on radio, but there's a list of crimes, and it's everything from DUI to homicide to child molest, rape, assault, possession of weapons. So it runs the whole gamut. And those are the facts, what the correlation to crime in general involving undocumented.
Right.
I don't think there's any really real facts in play to support it.
Well, then, could you give us a sense of your, of your general policing philosophy of working in a place where you know there are going to be a number of undocumented workers or folks here? I mean, how do you go about that knowing that is the case?
Well, I think that our field operations, and it's been this way for 15 or 20 years, we do not enforce immigration law out on the street. And I police 5 of the cities in the county, and I've talked to the other 5 police chiefs of the other remaining cities, and they do not enforce immigration laws, and there's no intent to change that whatsoever. We don't want victims of crime, witnesses of crime, to be any more afraid to talk to us than they are now. So absent being arrested and being booked in the jail, there's no law enforcement interaction with ICE at all.
Right. Gabriela Navarro-Bush, I want you to weigh in on this. Has that been your experience working with the Ventura County Sheriff's Department?
In the last couple of years, that's been the experience, is that I haven't seen that many ICE holds. In the past, I'm just estimating maybe about 8 to 9 years ago, it wasn't unusual for me to get 3 or 4 calls for people that had ICE holds that were sitting in jail, that I would come in and interview them. In the last couple of years, it's really, I rarely get ICE holds, mm-hmm. calls on ICE holds.
Well, Sheriff.
You know, let me jump in there, because I think this is an important point to raise. I think the sheriff would be able to attest that it's just not Ventura County that's how it's being processed. That's how almost all the sheriffs throughout the state are doing the exact same thing.
Mm. Well, this, I think, brings up this interesting concept of sanctuary cities or not sanctuary cities, because, in fact, this has been highly debated now with Trump. Again, we should know that a sanctuary city has no actual necessary legal basis. It's a term that's kind of become more popularized recently, but it's called right now a city or county that protects undocumented immigrants by not prosecuting them for violating federal immigration laws. That's kind of the closest we can get. So, I mean, sure. Sheriff Dean, would you call Ventura County a sanctuary city, for example?
Well, using the definition that you say, that we don't prosecute people for immigration violations, I don't know of any county in the state of California that would be considered a sanctuary city. I think a more at least acceptable definition in the law enforcement circuit is a sanctuary city is one that refuses to those even booked inside their jail to provide any information to ICE.
Right.
And where'd you get that definition, Jonathan? Because I don't think that was in the executive order today.
Okay. Well, there's a lot of different definitions.
The executive order
is
what the sheriff just said.
But there is an interesting example, Sheriff Dean, of San Francisco. You have called that is the only sanctuary city, technically. Is that correct?
Of the 58 counties, San Francisco is the only county that refuses to cooperate with ICE.
Okay.
Something I want to add in regards to just talking about ICE holds and the deportation of undocumented individuals. So I hear your numbers in terms of Ventura County, but since 2009 and with the deportation of almost 2.5 million people since 2009 under the Obama administration, we saw at least 2/3 of that population that was deported have either minor infractions or no criminal records at all. And so I think it's really important to talk about that, even though those numbers sound really small when we talk about countywide. Something's happening here in terms of undocumented immigrants not having access to due process in criminal court and getting sent straight to removal procedures, which I think is something so important to this conversation when we talk about who's getting deported and who's not, is that often we have people being charged for a crime but never convicted and deported before that. And so I've worked and organized around a lot of deportation cases like that, where folks didn't have due process, but they were sent to a detention center because they had an ICE hold. And that's information that counties or cities are sharing with ICE directly. That's access that ICE has to this information. And so something that a lot of folks are advocating for is due process for immigrants, so that we are actually verifying who is committing crimes or not, or what crimes are being committed before making assumptions that perpetuate these stereotypes about immigrants being being criminals, rapists, etc. That really create this stereotype and create further fear about who it is that's living in our community. And we know that Ventura County, everywhere else in the country, that's not the case. And so I think that having that discussion and that narrative really creates this sense of alienation and fear around the against and around the immigrant community.
Sheriff Dean, is there anything you would want to respond to in that?
Well, then a clarification of the law that happened in California. Before the Trust Act was passed in California, local law enforcement, if ICE placed a hold, could detain that person for 72 hours after they were released under local charges. That no longer happens anywhere in the state of California. So she makes a valid point, I don't know the answer to, of those that, say, on my list of crimes that were deported for child molest or homicide or rape, were they found guilty? And I don't know, this is anecdotal. Generally, on a serious crime like that, ICE will wait until the local charge is adjudicated and then do that. But I don't know that for sure, or in how many of these cases that takes place, or if ICE removes them while the charges are still pending.
Well, let me stay with you here, Sheriff Dean. Here, I think, is one of the major fears, is that the federal government and the president is allowed to determine which laws should result in deportations, essentially, right?
Yes.
And right now we're hearing terms that there could be 2 to 3 million undocumented criminals out there. And there is this fear suddenly that Trump could say, well, if you haven't paid a traffic violation or something of that line, we could potentially deport you now. And I think what we want to know is, will our police and will our sheriff deputies here, will they be working with ICE if that is the case to make those arrests?
Now, it's not going to change anybody's policy on who we arrest or who we don't arrest. Someone's immigration status has absolutely nothing to do with it. If it's an arrestable offense, and in that particular county, it's policy that you arrest for that offense, it'll happen. Now, it's different. L.A. County is so crowded, they won't accept misdemeanor arrests. They write them a citation. In our county, while we're crowded, we'll accept all the arrests, and we'll book them in, and then they'll release them. Now, understand, ICE is only there generally Monday through Friday, 8 to 5. So if someone gets booked in my jail on a misdemeanor warrant, and as long as there's not multiple warrants, the judge or one of my deputies is probably going to release them, and they're going to be out of custody within 5 or 6 hours, only because I don't have room for them. So it's not going to change what field-level officers are doing, what someone's immigration status. That's local policy on what people arrest for and what they book for.
What about the issue, let's say, one of Trump's promises is potentially to double or triple the number of ICE agents? So if there are more ICE agents available, is it potential that they could then be picked up from your jail if that's the case?
I guess it could. That's kind of up to them where, you know, if they hire more people, what they're going to do with those additional resources. But it doesn't change, again, no impact on what local law enforcement does.
Back to our immigration lawyer.
So would have that 72-hour period. That's California law.
Right.
So, I mean, that they would have to be there within that 72-hour period if they hypothetically, which I don't think is a hypothetical that's going to take place in reality, wanted to make that, you know, a major...
There is no 72-hour. They have to be there. They have to be there to pick them up before their local charge or adjudicated.
Before the local, yeah.
Yeah, okay. We don't hold them for 72 hours after.
Right, okay.
And back to Gabriela Navarro-Bush, just to get your thoughts on the potential and the futures here. Does this all make sense to you and resonate considering the folks you speak to every day?
Well, one thing I want to clarify is the majority of the people that are in immigration custody typically start their trip to immigration custody at a local jail. Depending on how quickly the immigration officer comes to pick them up, they can conceivably from the jail go into an immigration detention center. But immigration officers are law enforcement officers that have the same access to multiple databases to find people. As soon as they know that they have an immigrant, a non-citizen, that has committed a crime that they consider a serious misdemeanor or a serious felony, they will go out and look for that person. They will either look for them at home, they have a relationship with the probation department. So there's very different ways that an immigration officer will encounter an undocumented individual where there's a record of their crime. There's other ways by applying for some form of relief that you're not eligible for, such as applying for asylum in order to get a work permit. There's a lot of ways that people find themselves in deportation proceedings. It's not just through an ICE hold at the Ventura County Jail or LA County Jail. I used to see those a lot. I don't see those anymore. But now what I see more is that the person is detained in this area, transferred to Camarillo. From Camarillo, there's an ICE office there. They go straight to LA County, and then they look for a place where they're going to be detained for an immigration proceeding. I see a lot more of that, where there's little to no relief for the people, where before you would be able to fight your immigration case while you were free and living, you know, with your family and trying to pursue some type of immigration reform or immigration relief.
If you're just joining us, this is KCRW. I'm Jonathan Bastian, and we're live at Oxnard College for a conversation about undocumented workers under a Trump administration. One more question here for the sheriff, because I want to address the news that came out today, which is the idea that even though we could debate what a sanctuary city is, Trump believes they do exist, and he would like to remove federal funding for them. And now I'd like to know, for example, how much money do you get from the federal government? And if this is removed, could it change the way that you police this community at all?
Well, I guess if we were a sanctuary city and if we did lose, at least it depends. If they lose all federal money for law enforcement, for me it could be several million dollars countywide. I mean, there's a large portion of our medical services that we provide that are federally funded. It could be millions and millions of dollars if, in fact, that was to happen.
And do you think for other agencies around the state or other colleagues, I mean, is this a concern that people are talking about right now?
Well, budgets are always tight, and we scrape for every dollar. So whether you lose, you know, $1 million or $500,000, it's paying for a police officer or services. It certainly could have an impact.
Okay.
And my understanding is the executive order today, the only city in California that is considered a sanctuary city as far as that executive order is concerned, that would qualify as San Francisco.
Right.
Well, and you have other cities, maybe like Chicago, that might fit in. I have no idea.
And I want to get some reaction to this, because San Francisco is the city where there is no communication between police and ICE. And this is very hotly debated, and I want to go to Naira Pacheco here. Do you think, for example, that if you're undocumented and let's say you commit a murder, I mean, do you think that there should be no communication with ICE? You should not be deported, and really it should just be handled within the city itself?
Well, going back to that, I think due process in civil court and criminal court is completely necessary in addressing these issues. So I'm not here someone to address the moral issues around these pieces, because it's connected to the demoralization of my own humanity. But one thing in relation to sanctuary cities that I think is important that we redraw this narrative is not whether we should support having sanctuary cities or not because of federal funding, but being outraged of the fact that we have a president who's threatening to take away federal funding from larger cities that affect our medical services, that affect our public services, not whether we should have sanctuary cities that protect our communities. And so I think we really need to reframe from saying, oh, are sanctuary cities bad or not, but be outraged about the fact that this is happening in our country, that there's a threat against our own county and city budgets. Something that, you know, to say in regards to sanctuary cities, I think that you know, in light of the election and inauguration, a lot of cities have really taken upon themselves, even school boards. The Board of Trustees at Santa Barbara City College is making a decision on a similar resolution tonight about creating sanctuary safe spaces for undocumented people. And I think that it is important symbolism to be able to outrightly say we're here to support this community. But it is important to create resolutions that authentically protect undocumented immigrants. And so that means that, yes, it's not just symbolic about we're not going to continue collaboration, because I'm hearing, you know, from your end that there has been no collaboration between ICE, yet we're seeing a dramatic increase in deportations in the last 10 years. So something's happening. And I personally don't want to see just, no, we're not collaborating, we're not helping ICE. I want to see a complete cutoff of transfer of information between ICE and local law enforcement. Because whether or not the police or sheriffs are directly sharing that information or handing these people over, ICE is having access to this information. And that's creating the situation for these people who are detained to be interviewed by ICE, to be manipulated into signing their own deportations. All of these issues that just get lost in translation when we stray from talking about this narrative about whether locally we collaborate or ICE. And so in order to create real protection for undocumented community, that would mean taking an outright stance against what's happening and saying, no, we're not going to do that, and we're going to hold back from even what we've been doing. We're going to take a more extreme measure to protect our communities.
Gabriela Navarro-Bush, our immigration lawyer, to continue this thread here, I mean, would you go as far as saying that there should be no communication between local law enforcement and ICE whatsoever, you know, altogether? Or do you think, just to put it very frankly, if somebody commits a very serious crime in this country and they're undocumented, that they should be deported?
So, I mean, you're looking at two distinct responsibilities. One is local law enforcement to protect the community and enforce the laws. The other one are immigration offenses. And when we have somebody that has committed a very serious crime, they get prosecuted through our local court system. They do their time in jail. And if that person is facing a deportation, then depending on the type of crime, yes. If somebody has been arrested for a DUI, I don't think that they should be deported. If somebody was arrested for a serious felony, a rape or a murder, and they completed their jail term here in the United States, then they should be returned back to their home country. I mean, we have to at some point take a stand that some people should not be living here in the United States. They should be afforded the opportunity to present their best case, to have due process, but at some point, we have to take a stand.
This is an interesting question to go back to Sheriff Dean here, and it kind of reflects something we were saying earlier, but in your mind, if you could talk, if you're allowed to talk, just as a human with some thoughts outside of just the code of laws here, I mean, a case like a DUI, for example, do you think that should result in deportation when the ramifications of breaking a family up could be huge, or... I'd love to hear your thoughts on this.
You know, I've been doing this job for 39 years, and I stay neutral on the issues. The easy part of my job is I enforce them. I don't make them. And just to clarify a point that was made over here, I didn't say that we don't collaborate. If they come into our jail, we share the information. Out on the field, we do no immigration enforcement at all. So the facts are clear.
Exactly. So, in essence, there's still collaboration. There's still interaction.
Oh, yeah.
So what I'm specifying is in order to authentically protect our undocumented community, we need to eliminate that collaboration, that interaction, that exchange of information. Regardless of what it's looked like in the past, we need to take a proactive stance and not collaborate, share information at all.
But would that be going too far, do you think, Sheriff Dean?
We're going to agree to disagree on that, I guess. I feel if you commit a crime that's going to, in this day and age, end up in a county, you end up and get booked into one of our jails, and you happen to be in the country illegally, then it's fine and our obligation to cooperate with ICE if they're violating federal law.
Let's move on here.
What I'm finding frustrating, maybe I shouldn't have been on this panel because we were talking about undocumented. And the first half of this whole show has focused in on undocumented that have committed crimes. I've been spending 30 years of my life trying to help all those undocumented that haven't committed crimes, which is probably 95% of that population that we're talking about. And we haven't talked about that at all. Why don't we talk about that group of people that are some of the hardest working people that you're ever going to find? Because that's the real undocumented issue in this country. And I don't think this whole discussion should just be focused on what happens with people that are here undocumented that commit crimes.
I think it's important to have this conversation, although I agree that I don't want to spend an hour talking about debating immigrant criminality. But I think that's what it is in this country. I am considered a criminal. That's the reality. There's farm workers who are considered criminals. They're not exclusive communities. And in fact, the whole issue, my struggle is the fact that we are all criminalized, that immigrant communities are under a state in this country where we're constantly criminalized no matter what we do or what we don't do, whether they're actual criminal offenses.
And that gets into
I agree that we should change the subject.
The first half hour has been talked about solely people that have committed crimes.
Mike Stoker, we're going to move on right now, okay? And I want to get your take on this because we're going to go straight back to the news right now, which was a Trump executive order today, which was to go ahead and build the wall. That could potentially slow down immigration that's coming into Oxnard. You've worked very closely with farmers here as well. And I'm hearing from a lot of farmers saying, we already have, we don't even have enough workers as is right now. And so I'd like to get your take if you think that this wall was the right way to go about this situation and how you think it will affect labor here with our farms as well.
Yeah, I think we need to have secure borders. I think if we would have had secure borders and people not being able to come into this country many times with coyotes and a lot of other different ways to get into this country, it would have forced us to have the solution in terms of either H-2A, which is one solution out there, but not one that I advocate, but primarily on immigration reform. Back in 1986, when President Reagan granted amnesty, a lot of us that were involved with that issue, myself included, said IRCA, the Immigration Reform Comprehensive Act in 1986, was not going to solve the problem unless we had a labor component going forward. And we didn't have a labor component going forward. And now here we are, 40 years later or whatever, that we're having this issue because we did not have a labor component. My whole focus the last 30 years of my life on this issue has to get a labor component. I guarantee those same farmers you're talking to, if you were to give them an immigration reform package that would either allow all their workers that are here currently to apply tomorrow, be vetted if they haven't committed serious crimes, be either given legal status with a 3-year work permit or a 4-year work permit, and then you can get into the details how you renew it and that kind of thing, or if you have an immigration reform package for a pathway to citizenship or citizenship, which is never going to pass as long as the Republicans have the Congress or as long as the Republicans is in the presidency, all those growers and a lot of those farm workers that I do deal with on a regular basis, they would be more than happy. They want the framework that they can come from the underground and not have to worry anymore about being here and being worried about if you get pulled over and what's going to happen, the things you were talking about earlier. And the only way that's going to happen is through an immigration reform package that I feel optimistic that we're going to get. It probably won't have a pathway to citizenship. Anybody that gets on the work program can apply for citizenship like anyone else, but they're going to have a pathway to be here and be here legally and continue to keep doing what they're doing in this country. And that's where I'm putting all my focus and putting all my energy, which I've been doing for 25 years. But at first time, I think we actually have a chance to do it.
Well, let's listen right now to a farm owner in Oxnard. His name is Bob Jones, and we had a chance to speak to him recently leading up to this, and he had some thoughts about this subject. Let's take a listen.
Are afraid to cross the border with the politics and the fees that are charged these days. There needs to be some type of guest worker program. They have one now, which is H-2A, but it's contingent upon housing, and with such a housing shortage in the county, we can't get all the labor here. It's down in Mexico and available. We just can't get it here because we don't have homes that are affordable to get them into.
Agree 100% with Bob.
So, I mean, is
Ventura County Ag Association, Rob Roy, has been working very, very hard on the same issue and supporting what Bob's been supporting and works with me on the Agricultural Coalition for Immigration Reform in Washington.
Okay. Gabriela Navarro-Bush here, an immigration lawyer. This is a program that some have referred to at times. It's almost like a Bracero program. And that term brings up a lot of different thoughts, and there's a lot of history to it. I mean, would you be supportive of a program where we let people come in, we keep them near our farms, they work, and then they must leave again? Is that something that you would support?
There's a lot of abuses in those types of programs. There were a lot of abuses in the Bracero program, and the H-2A program can also have some abuses. And I think that if there's a component in order to prevent the abuses, to be able to provide the workers with the same rights and responsibilities as citizens, that if they're injured on the job, if they're sick, just the ability to be able to live wherever they want to live. There is a lot of abuses that could be associated with the H-2A program, just like any other immigration program. There's definitely abuses. What I don't understand is how a wall will facilitate the ability for workers to come in. Instead of building a wall, we should be building some form of bridge in order to be able to bring people in the United States, have them live here with dignity, have them work with dignity, and then be able to return to their home country, that freedom of being able to come back and forth. The majority of the undocumented immigrants that are here in the United States are not people that snuck in across the border. They're people that came in on visas. They came on visas and they overstayed. And immigration has a record of when they came in and the fact that they never left. We have a system that doesn't track that. Instead, we focus on the farm workers that may or may not have entered with the visa, probably not. But, we definitely need a guest worker program, and it shouldn't just be focused on farmers, but on all types of industry. We just need to reform our immigration laws so that people can live and work here with dignity, be able to live with their family, visit their family, I just think that we need to be more compassionate, and building a wall is not the way to do it.
Back to Mike Stoker, agricultural law attorney and former Santa Barbara County supervisor. Well, in your mind, I mean, what would a worker program look like that took away maybe some of those potential abuses that Gabriela is talking about?
Well, first off, the abuses, where the Bracero program was back in 1958 and where we are today, in terms of the laws that we have on the books, in terms of the employee protections. State of California doesn't care whether you're working in a field or working at McDonald's, whether you're here illegally or whether you're here legally, in terms of Cal OSHA, in terms of the Department of Labor, the Division of Labor Standards Enforcement. I can go down all the mandates that that employee is going to be protected. So we're dealing with an entirely different situation that I guarantee, and I don't think there's any state out there that would be any different than California, that the states that have these labor protections for their employees are going to say, well, we're not going to look at it. You know, we're Cal OSHA and we heat stress. No, you're here illegally in the field. No, we're not going to apply the law to you. I guarantee they apply the law to everybody. And so you look at a lot of those violations or wherever they are. I mean, I'd welcome working with people like you in terms of as a program is rolled out, show us where it needs to be dealt with to make sure those protections are there. But, you know, I said earlier, I don't support H-2A for that very reason. I think the ultimate solution is immigration reform. The immigration reform, when you have legal status and you have a work permit, is not just come here. H-2A requires you to come here, you finish your contract, and you have to go back. The kind of program I'm talking about is where you're going to get a 3 to 4 year work permit. And if I could have a pathway to citizenship, I'd go for it. But it's not going to happen, folks. I mean, the expertise I bring to this panel is knowing the politics of this issue. And the only way you're going to get immigration reform in this country, if it's going to have citizenship in it, then you better have 60 Democrats in the Senate, and you better have a majority of Democrats in the House, and you better have a Democrat in the presidency. Or you're not going to get immigration reform with a pathway to citizenship. I think we have an opportunity now. If we can't get citizenship or a pathway to citizenship, we can have a work permit for 3 to 4 years that you don't pick this field and then have to go back. You're there for the 3 to 4 year period, probably go back to your country of origin, in a lot of cases will be Mexico, for 1 month before you can request a renewal. You get the renewal and you come right back. That's the kind of program what I envision. I'm going to be working hard that I think we have a chance of potentially getting through in the next year or two in Congress.
You're listening to KCRW live from Oxnard College. I'm Jonathan Bastian. And tonight we're discussing the future of undocumented immigrants in Southern California under the Trump administration. And I think we find ourselves in an interesting moment of this conversation. I want to bring in Naira Pacheco, part of DACA, who has been undocumented for years. We're talking about different scenarios in which we would have these guest worker programs. But in these programs, it doesn't seem like there's a likelihood for citizenship. And there's arguments that actually, a lot of folks that come here, they don't necessarily want to be citizens. They're happy just to come and work and go home again. Is that your experience? Or do you find that, in fact, most people that come here really, they want to be American citizens in the end?
Well, to start off, to speak for myself, when I came here and being very aware of my undocumented status and being very aware in which the environment that I was in did not welcome my existence and my presence, I was always very proud to be Mexicana, to be from Oaxaca, and was receiving messages from all around media, politics, school, that I couldn't be American because of my legal status. And so over the years, through the organizing, the policy work, and activism and work with youth, I've learned to be able to define my own humanity and my own integrity and dignity as a human, not based on my nationality or immigration status, which I think is something that is a detriment to the immigrant community here, that is constantly has the pressure of feeling like we need to assimilate, and assimilation means American citizenship in order to fit in. And when American citizenship is denied to us, then we're outsiders. So while I myself don't identify as American or United States CN, because America is a whole continent, I do think that in having this conversation about should we give temporary work permits versus citizenship, I would say that no, labor practices that are respectable, that respect the dignity of farm workers, are not in practice and implemented right now. And in fact, we have a whole organization in the Central Coast that's dedicated to addressing farm worker abuses. And I believe KCRW would have hosted a whole forum and panel discussion on this were it not the election. So I disagree that that's not happening, and would definitely foresee the expansion of farm worker abuses happening under a guest worker program. So I think the thing about immigration is it forces for us to see all of the different aspects of America's and as a country. We have to look at the way our agricultural practices are not working for the environment, for our workers, for our community. We have to look at how housing policy isn't helping our communities to the point that we can't even afford to have our farm workers live here to pick our food. We have to think about the environmental destruction that's happening by creating building a wall that's going to affect both our environment in Mexico and in this country. And so, you know, when I think about, would I prefer, in my situation, do I prefer DACA over nothing? Yes, I prefer having a work permit where I can use my bachelor's degree and work with it. But ultimately, do I recognize that having U.S. citizenship grants me dignity in this country and grants dignity to my community and my family? And I think that's ultimately what we deserve. And so what I hear, when I hear people talking about a guest worker program and, oh, they just really want to work, it's completely dismissing the family separations, the trauma that farm worker communities go through. And to me, it sends me the message that our communities are completely disposable. That as long as we can come here and work and go back, then that's all we're worth.
Mike Stoker, any response?
Well, yeah, I could start with, you know, I welcome you having that next forum, because I understand there were some, I think you got a county supervisor out here, and I think there were some workshops held, and state officials came down and said, if you got any complaints, call us. We'll enforce it. We can have that debate on another day. I deal with those agencies all the time, and any of you are in the audience, if you're an employee, you know, you can email me at mikestoker@aol.com, and if you have any violations that are taking place against you, I guarantee I can put you in touch with the state agency, and they're going to follow up with it, and they're going to presume that you are telling the truth and the employer has committed a crime. So I felt duty-bound to respond to that aspect, acting like there's all these violations taking place out there. I don't know, we have our county supervisor in here, maybe want to comment on what he heard in those workshops. In terms of the other issue, the bottom line is this. I've supported every immigration package that had citizenship. It's not going to happen. I want to get the best we can, and what I do believe is a possibility, and again, a lot of the farm workers I've dealt with that are here illegally, if you give them the option, some of them ultimately may want to choose citizenship, but if you ask them, is that really the compelling issue right now for you? Majority that I've dealt with have said, I just want to be here in a legal status, in a legal framework. And the 3 to 4 year work permit with the automatic ability to renew, with provisions in terms of families being able to be here, I really believe those details can be worked out. Is it going to be what everybody in this room wants? No, this is a real this is a complicated problem that we're no better off today than we were in 1995 when I was testifying before Congress. So if we want to stay where we're at and maintain the status quo, we can be having this kind of conversation for the next 20 years. I would bet you if we had a framework where everybody that was here illegally could apply, and if you haven't committed a serious crime, could get your 3 to 4 year work permit, I would bet the discussion we would have the next time we have a forum 2 years after that happened would be completely different than the discussion we're having tonight. And I'm going to work because that's the best chance we have to have a chance of dealing with this issue for the first time ever. And I think if we put our energies on that focus, I think we have a good chance to make it happen.
Okay, moving on here to a very sensitive subject that is also was spoken about as Trump was campaigning was the potential elimination of DACA. The Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals created in 2002 by President Obama. Again, some 700,000 people have qualified for this, including Naira Pacheco up on stage. We're going to hear from you in 1 second. But going quickly to our immigration attorney, Gabriela Navarro-Bush, how concerned are you that this could be a reality, that this program could be eliminated, and are you hearing from a lot of folks? I mean, in fact, I heard just before you were here, you were meeting with dozens of folks with that are DACA recipients. Is that right?
Yes, I was. I was with a number of students from Cal State Channel Islands that are DACA students, and they, you know, just in different schools that I've been to, they're all very worried about what can happen. I'm not going to speculate as to what this new president is going to do about DACA. Everybody has their own opinion. If nothing happens, it will continue. To this day, immigration is still processing DACA applications. But the fear is that this information will be used for enforcement purposes. I talk about the worst-case scenario. Worst-case scenario is that our DACA recipients will receive a letter from immigration if it's ended, and this information is used for enforcement purposes, is that they would have to surrender their work permit, surrender to an immigration officer, possibly be placed in deportation proceedings. That is the worst-case scenario. Definitely other avenues come in which you can fight your immigration case, and one of the students, or one of the people at the event earlier today, said that she welcomes the ability to fight her case to remain in the United States before an immigration judge. But it took a lot of courage, not only for Nireya to be here to tell us what her status is, but to also continue with the fight and being able to try to remain here in the United States. There's this genuine fear that people have. There's tears. There's this emotional component of being removed physically from your family. And I think that that's what the genuine fear is. What I hope is that he just leaves it alone and just lets it go, just lets it continue. If he does nothing and doesn't issue any executive order, it will continue to proceed. It doesn't put the DACA recipients on a pathway to citizenship, but it doesn't deport them. I mean, these were young kids that trusted our government when our government said, come out of the shadows, get a work permit for 2 years. And then now they're afraid that that information is going to be used for enforcement purposes. Right. And that's the fear that I have. And I'm sure it's the same fear that Nireya and a number of different people have.
And a quick correction. The program was created in 2012, not 2002, as I stated. Now going to Naira Pacheco, clearly a program which changed your life. And when you heard that this might be on the chopping block, your reaction to it?
Definitely, you know, on a personal level, this has direct consequences for me, meaning like I literally cannot work anymore. So I definitely have to admit that fear, uncertainty, all patterns throughout my life are just elevated and heightened during this period. So for me, it does mean, right, figuring out what do I do with a bachelor's degree that I can't work with. But at the same time, I've been working, I've been paying taxes, sales taxes since I came here, but income tax since I was 16 years old without a work permit. And so on an individual basis, that's what keeps me strong, is recognizing that myself, the community that I come from, the family that I come from, we are dedicated to surviving and thriving no matter what. And so for me, and when I think about the numbers of DACA recipients in Santa Barbara and Ventura County, it's about almost 10,000 DACA recipients across both counties, you know, in spaces where we have almost 100,000 undocumented immigrants. I'm more concerned about our community as a whole than just a fraction of us. And so for me, it is about protecting what we already have, which was not granted to us by President Obama just because he wanted to, but it was something that people and social movements, youth immigrant movements, really had to organize and advocate for simply for a work permit. And so for me, it's a reminder that we constantly have to advocate for more, because we advocated for more and we got, you know, 10% of us in these counties to be able to be granted DACA. But there's, you know, thousands and thousands of undocumented immigrants who, whether DACA remains or not, are still in danger.
Hmm. Now I want to go to Sheriff Dean, who's been a little quiet here, but I want to bring
I'm
you back
with,
in.
I'm good with that.
Yeah, I'm sure you're happy. because we're wrapping up here in the last 7 minutes, but again, we were here to really focus on a lot of things we've heard from Trump, some of the fears moving forward. And we played a clip earlier in which Trump used some pretty hostile language about those coming across the border. And I wonder, I don't know who you voted for, but when you hear that type of rhetoric and you're policing in a community, do you feel that it has in some way just fueled the flames of certain tensions here? And it's something you would like to move beyond, or are you okay with it?
No, it's unfortunate. And I don't care what president you are, what political race it is, what side you're on, the rhetoric that increases during campaign is almost disgusting. And there's no way it can't help but raise the fears of those that might be touched, whether it's immigration, whether it's Obamacare, no matter what it is, people are touched by that. I always just like to say is, please don't listen to all the garbage. Take a breath and let's see what actually happens. Or deal with it on the front end and advocate for something not happening. And you know, I've sent letters out to most of the school districts and superintendents about nothing's changing. No matter what the president does, local law enforcement is not changing its immigration enforcement stance. So please be calm. Please don't, at least from that portion of it that we can affect, try not to get too worried.
And in fact, for DACA recipients who are feared of deportation, I mean, is there anything you can say to them, or is this really outside of your jurisdiction?
It's completely outside of our jurisdiction. We'll have absolutely nothing to do with that at all.
Well, back to Mike Stoker here, agricultural attorney, and somebody who did, even though you said reluctantly, support Trump. This type of rhetoric, is this something that you've had a hard time with too, or how do you feel?
You know, my answer is the same. I've been in that arena. You know, I mean, people say disgusting things on both sides of the aisle, and I'm not going to spend time on, you know, what did Hillary say, and did she mean it? What did Trump say, and did he mean it? You know, the race is over, the election's over, it's time to move on. What I would say for DACA, you know, let's focus back on the issue. I can tell you that I've seen nothing but encouraging. I've had a lot of input with senior advisors with the Trump administration since he won that election. On 60 Minutes interview, he talked about all the hardworking people that are in this country illegally, that are good people, that we have to find a way to figure out to allow them to stay here. Right. I've seen nothing but, I can give you, LA Times had some stories this last Sunday and Monday. I can give you quotes from Sean Spicer, his press secretary, from Trump in the last 2 to 3 weeks talking about DACA's not being focused in on. That's not where they're going. The focus was basically secure the border, which is the wall, which was the executive order today, and focus on anybody here illegally. But this is something I think everybody in the audience should be thinking about, and I'm speculating based on what I know politically and the kind of person that's very active on strategy, on when do you roll out this press conference or that press conference. Today was the day to deal with the undocumented. It had the executive order on sanctuary cities. It had the executive order in terms of building the wall. And if you were going to deal with DACA, you know, and all it takes is an executive order from the president. This is one of them, an executive order, and it's over. This would have been the day you would have had an executive order that right. would have been included in that whole package, and it wasn't there.
Yeah.
And I think that's a good sign. And I back to what the sheriff said, take a breath and let's see going forward. And I feel very, very positive. I think the whole DACA program is not going to be a focus okay. of anything changed at the federal level.
We're nearly out of time, and I want to pose one last question to our panelists here, if you can answer it in just about 45 seconds. Let's just imagine a scenario. You could sit down with President Trump yourself, and you could advise him on policy moving forward. What advice would you give him? And we'll start with Sheriff Dean.
Get a haircut?
Number two.
I'd say talk to people in the real world and get a real grasp of what's going on in people's everyday lives and get in touch with what's going on before you make any decisions that affect everyone.
Our immigration lawyer, Gabrielle Navarro-Bush, what would you tell him? What would you ask him?
I would truly ask him to put together a good panel of people from diverse areas of the community and move forward on doing some type of immigration reform that brings humanity into the aspect, into the reform, allows people to remain together as families, allows people to work here in the United States with dignity. And the main component would be to bring groups from different, people from different areas of the community. It can't just be one focus, one group. It's not just agriculture. It's all across the board. That's what I would say.
And to our agricultural law attorney and former Republican County Supervisor in Santa Barbara, Mike Stoker, what advice would you
give? Well, I'll save you time. I think I pretty much have strongly advocated what I believe, and I've let them know. I agree with what the previous two speakers just said, and I think you're going to see a very large audience. I think he's made that very clear. I mean, I think he showed it with meeting with a lot of labor lawyers or labor representatives, organized labor, the construction trades, the building trades, folks that Republicans normally aren't seen, you know, dealing with, and he got nothing but great reviews for having an open mind and a genuine belief from their perspective that he really wants to hear the input on how you solve these problems.
And finally, Naira Pacheco of Just Communities.
Step down and self-deport. And I say this, you're hurting our communities. Immigration is not just an issue about Mexicans for south of the border. It's a black issue. It's an issue that's affecting our Muslim brothers and sisters, our Muslim community, our trans and queer immigrants. You are destroying and displacing our communities, and it's having a global effect. So step down and self-deport.
Well, we are going to end it there this evening. I want to thank our guests, our hosts at Oxnard College, and to the Ventura County Star for partnering with us tonight on tonight's event. And of course, thank you to our audience, both here in the theater and those listening to our broadcast. This conversation was produced by Catherine Barnes. Tonight's live event was produced by Aaron Sine. Our technical director is Phil Richards, backed by KCRW's chief engineer, Steve Herbert, and engineers David Green and Duncan Brode. You're listening to member-supported KCRW Santa Monica, Los Angeles, KDRW Santa Barbara, KCRI Indio, Palm Springs, KCRU Oxnard Ventura, and KCRY Mojave, a community service of Santa Monica College and NPR for Southern California. Coming up for our radio listeners, music for your Wednesday nights with DJ Garth Trinidad. I'm Jonathan Bastian, and thank you all for coming tonight. Now, we are just going to have 2 to 3 questions here.